Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Nick Huber. He on Twitter goes by Sweaty Startup. He has been making a lot of rounds talking about how people can start a side gig, make money by doing things that people don't want to do. And I've been following his Twitter account for quite a while. He has a YouTube channel as well that goes by Nick Huber, a Reddit subreddit called Sweaty Startup. A lot of things going on. I want to dive into his mind to try to pull out some tidbits of wisdom and knowledge to help us on how we could build income if we don't have enough income, how we could perhaps start a business from maybe the most modest means and places. So Nick, welcome on the show. How are you doing?
Dave, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your work and I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah. You write some really interesting tweets. You have a very unique kind of perspective on business. And one of the reasons why I want you on is because I kind of resonate with it. Like, I feel like you have a unique angle of start a business super small. You know, it doesn't have to be like a big thing. You don't have to put $10,000-$20,000 on it in it. You could just start with $100 or nothing. And go ahead, make some money right off the bat in the first month, make $1,000 and do something that people don't want to do, like clean some gutters or clean bathrooms or, you know, haul stuff, move stuff. And it's a really interesting take because it goes against traditional entrepreneurship, where it's like, oh, take a small business loan, borrow $100,000 or open up a storefront business or something big. You're taking it from this really unique angle of going micro, using a lot of hustle and using your brains to really do something that, you know, is a need and creating value right off the bat. So I'm like, wow, man, you've got something really interesting going here. I'm curious, like, can you break this down for us a bit, kind of this whole pitch you have of how people can start a business successfully without spending a ton of money and how they do it from step one? So, like, what's your first kind of advice for people, you know, if they're wanting to do a side gig, increase their income?
Yeah, I think, you know, if I really boil it down to the main concepts of what I believe in, when you go up to somebody on the street and ask them, you know, what does entrepreneurship mean to you? The answer is probably, you know, Shark Tank or new invention or again, a storefront. And you think like, okay, who is an entrepreneur? Like name a famous entrepreneur. They're almost all going to say Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, or Mark Zuckerberg. In reality, you know, that type of entrepreneurship, while it can be very, very rewarding and you can make billions of dollars, the odds of success are pretty low for the average Joe, and it's not very approachable. It's not very approachable for somebody like me who grew up on a farm in Southern Indiana, went to college, and just needed to find a way to make a little bit of money so I could pay my rent. So, you know, my opinion is that that's all wrong, and that entrepreneurship is very much a, hey, let's go just be an opportunist and find a way to make a little bit of cash. Business is about momentum, right? You may see me on Twitter now and we're raising millions of dollars, buying all these self-storage facilities. We have 38 employees. We sold our service company for seven figures. But you fast forward to you go back to the very beginning and I was just a guy in Ithaca trying to make a little bit of money to pay for beer and rent, right? So we started driving around picking up boxes for students who were about to leave for the summer, stored them in our apartments. We literally used our cars that we already had, no cash. We went and picked up some boxes, put them in our apartments, and we worked our butt off for about a week and a half. And we, next thing we knew, we had $5,000 sitting there. And we're like, oh, well, maybe this is what entrepreneurship is about. And it's not necessarily about raising venture capital and trying to think of a new idea.
Yeah. So was it basically students needed a place to store their stuff for the summer and then they would get it back in the fall time?
Yeah, I think, you know, from when I was really young, my dad kind of instilled in me, like, when you're walking around the world, just think about how businesses operate. How does that business make money? How does this business make money? How does this business get customers? How do they, you know, employ people for good wages where they can make a little bit of extra off of, you know, providing an awesome service to somebody? And so it was all just a coincidence. I leased my apartment. I put my apartment on Craigslist to lease back when Craigslist was the way to lease your apartment over the summer. I was leaving to go home for the summer. And I didn't get any hits to lease it because everybody was doing it and Ithaca was going to be empty over the summer. So, I basically got an email from a student who said, hey, I don't want to lease your place, but I want to put my stuff in your place. The company that I used last year to do pickup and delivery storage was a big pain in the butt. I'm going home. Can you come and get my stuff and put it in your apartment? And I was like, well, $300 is better than $0. So, yes. And I went up there and I got it, put his stuff in my room. And then I was like, well, now I might as well try to get some other people because I can't lease this apartment anymore. So drove around, put up flyers, went to, you know, sorority fraternity meetings and gave my pitch of why they should store their stuff with me. Next thing I knew, my entire room was so full, I could not even get in. Then I had a friend in college town with a basement and his big house. And we filled that basement. We filled up a couple bedrooms in that house, and 50 customers paid us an average of $300 to store their stuff over the summer. And we made a little bit of money.
Wow. Okay. So let's unpack this a bit. So before this, was this like your first kind of business opportunity where you saw kind of this opportunity to hustle, make some money, be creative? Or was there something before this that kind of, you know, led up to this point?
I ran a lawn care company in elementary school. My dad is has been a tremendous influence on me. He's also very excitable and energetic. And he goes to work one day when I'm 13 years old. So I'm in, what is that, seventh grade. He goes to work one day and his boss says, you know, we have a problem. Some of these properties that we own in town, the guy who runs them is, you know, he quit. He quit on the job. We don't have anybody to mow the lawn. And my dad said, Nick can do it. And his boss is like, you're 13 year old. Mm-hmm. My dad said, yeah, he can do it. Signed me up for this. Put me in a truck, drove me to town with a trailer that I leased from the family, a mower that I leased from him. He sat me down and showed me a profit and loss statement, showed me what I needed to bill. And, mm-hmm. and, next thing I know, I had 13 commercial properties in town to mow the lawn. And, it was a experience as a 13 year old. I cried the first day when I mowed over a bunch of trash and it got all on the lawn. Uh-huh. But yeah, I ended up having to hire a high schooler to drive me to town to do the mowings. We lived about 15 minutes away. And I learned a little bit about business, hiring, billing, management, and you know, just trying to make some money.
How much money were you making back then?
I went to school with about 40 grand in the bank, which wow. I went on to lose about half of it because I invested it all in blue chip stocks in about 2008, early 2008, right before the great financial crisis.
Yeah. Wow. So you graduate high school, you have 40,000 in the bank from running a business. How was that? Was that like, were your friends kind of like, hey, Nick, how do you have so much money? Or did you hire some of them? Or like,
yeah, I hired a lot of my friends. I hired my little brother. I was always just scrappy, right? My dad tried to hire me for his company for $20 an hour to fill a bunch of potholes in one of his parking lots. And instead I hired somebody for $12 an hour to do my job. And I collected the $8, right? I was just always a little bit scrappy like that.
Got it. So coming from that mentality where you started your own business, you're making money, was like, were you distracted at all from school at all? Like, was it like demotivating knowing that you can make money on the side?
Basically shut the business down and went to school. I had a chance to go to the Ivy League. I was running track and field there. I was enjoying myself. I had a girlfriend that's now my wife that I was really excited about. And I was just a student. I didn't consider myself an entrepreneur. I wasn't taking entrepreneurship classes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I graduated. So I was seeing my friends go off and get jobs for, you know, 60-100 grand a year in New York City, wherever. And my business partner and I decided to give this little student storage business a shot. So we set some pretty lofty goals because the opportunity cost of not going to get one of these jobs in New York City is pretty significant for an Ivy Leaguer. So we said, okay, we can't just do this service in Ithaca. We need to do it in Syracuse, in Iowa, in Indiana, and Illinois. So we convinced friends in those markets to start the company for us there. And got way out of our comfort zone, used some student loan money to buy 3 more cargo vans, set up operations, built a website, and just got after it.
So, okay, so let's go back to this. Okay, so in Ithaca, you did your first summer by, you know, not renting out your house, collecting boxes from students. What year in college were you back then?
I was a junior, just finishing up junior year. So all of senior year, we spent building the business. And that's when, okay, we're going to give it a shot. My partner and I made a promise to each other that we're going to give it 1 year after graduation. If we don't hit 250 customers, we need 250 customers or we're going to go get jobs. Like, that's the deal that we have to make with ourselves. And we got 256 customers. So we stuck at it.
Wow. Okay. So after junior year, you get, was it 50 people?
50 people the first year, just scrapping in Ithaca.
Got it.
And the next year at 3 locations, we got 250. That's when we leased warehouses. We bought cargo vans. We branded our company. We got flyers. We delivered boxes. We became an official, a real company.
Wow. So the next So after you graduate, so this is your whole senior year, you're prepping for this kind of, you know, launch.
Busy time, yeah.
Yeah,
busy time.
And then are you investing money to get these cargo vans and other stuff, or what are you doing? Or did you
We had a little bit of money lying around because we were always doing side jobs and finding ways to make money, but took out a little bit of student loans as well. And I'd say the initial investment that year, we invested all the $5,000 that we made in profit year one. And then we spent another maybe 10 on a couple cargo vans and a lot of boxes. But very soon after we spent that money, we had revenue coming in from the busy season. So it was bootstrapped. We never had investors or partners.
I mean, for the three locations, were they all just college towns storing their summer stuff, or was it other types of people that, like, how was it sustainable?
Yeah, it was a hard, hard business. I mean, looking back, this is a very difficult business. We had all part-time employees. We were operating in towns that we couldn't be. I mean, I was at the Ivy League championships about to run the hurdles, and I was taking customer service calls, you know, in this business. So, but yeah, all student stores, the company was called Storage Squad. It still exists. We sold the company last January, and, you know, the next year we did, you know, went to a couple more schools, did a little bit more in revenue. I think the trajectory was maybe $350,000 in revenue. Then $750,000 in revenue, then $1.5 million in revenue, then $2.1 million, then $2.3 million, then $2.5 million. The biggest we ever got was about $2.5 million in revenue in 2017, and then we shifted our focus over to real estate and started buying and building self storage facilities.
How many years after you graduated did you shift your focus to buying storage facilities?
A couple of years in, we realized that the business was never going to be super valuable. To sell. A service business is only worth, you know, 2, 3, 4 times profit, right? So it's never going to build a lot of generational wealth. It's always going to be really stressful. It's always going to be super busy during that seasonal time. So 2015 came around. We had about $500,000 sitting in the bank from this little sweaty startup that our friends had made fun of us for starting and made fun of our cargo van, right? We were still living very frugally. We decided to put all $500,000 into a self-storage development in Ithaca. We built a self-storage facility for $2.9 million from the ground up in Ithaca. Started in 2015, opened the doors in 2017. Then 2018, we bought another self-storage facility. 2019, we bought three more. 2020, we bought three more. And then 2021, this past year, we bought over $50 million worth of self-storage. So it's been a long time, a long journey, right? 10 years. We've been at it for over 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. Are you starting to, when did you start kind of raising outside capital, to get more storage facilities?
Yeah. That's the thing about real estate is that it's very capital intensive. We only had so much money. So yeah, we did our best to network and meet high net worth individuals who wanted to own part of a self storage facility. But our first deal, we raised a little bit of money on our very first deal.
Okay. Got it. And what do you, I'm curious, what's the pitch to high net worth individuals? Like, just like maybe in 30 seconds, like what kind of yield or what kind of return on investment are you giving these guys?
Yeah, so we run a real estate private equity company, which means, okay, we're managing and operating the self-storage facility, but we also acquire, put together the deals, raise money, and we syndicate deals. So our target's pretty simple. We target a 6% year one cash on cash return. And we try to add value to the property so that in a year or 2 years, we can do a refinance, pull a lot or all of our equity out, and then continue to own the building for a really long time. That's our strategy.
Got it. So for the...
And it turns out self-storage is an old school, sweaty business where not a lot of people who have MBAs and tech entrepreneurs focus in self-storage. So we're competing against a lot of companies that don't answer the phone, that don't have websites, that don't have online rentals. Yeah. We come in, we manage them remotely. Part of our team's in the Philippines, part in Colombia, a lot of them in the United States. You can pull up to one of our buildings. You can lease a unit online in 5 minutes. So, you know, streamlining it versus go to the office on the other side of town and sign a lease and get a key.
Yeah. So for investors, in your private equity side, so you're targeting 6% cash on cash, basically.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance, right? It depends on the deal. If there's a lot of upside down the road, maybe we'll be okay with less return right away. But generally, yeah, we're trying to have cash flow in place right away so that we, you know, have a healthy company on day one.
Okay, got it. And then is there a certain time in required? Like they can't pull out the money for a certain number of years?
Yeah, we have a long-term horizon. I mean, we want to hold these assets for a long time. And we also don't want to just lock in a big gain and sell, and then everybody has to pay taxes and figure out what they're going to do with the money again, right? So the goal is really to add the value. Maybe we buy a property for $3 million. We're going to make it worth $5 million by increasing revenue and decreasing expenses. We're going to put new debt on it to pull out our initial capital, put the $3 million of debt on it, and then we're going to hold it for 8-10 years, right? We want to operate it and enjoy the cash flow for a really long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. All right, so it seems like you know, we did a kind of a brush stroke of, you know, your background, your business. One of the themes it feels like is this thing of opportunity, right? Seizing an opportunity, and doing something that perhaps others aren't too interested in, right? And the first reaction I think most people will have is kind of like, well, I don't want to move boxes all day. Or for example, some of your suggestions in your other, you know, videos and tweets are like, clean gutters or
power wash.
Yeah. You know, like what if someone's like, I don't want to do that stuff, you know, like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, that's why it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. The things that are fun, right? Being a YouTuber, being an influencer, being a tech entrepreneur, having a social media app that you're starting, those are all fun and exciting things that a lot of people are interested in. Crypto, a lot of people are interested in these things. It's fun. If a business opportunity overlaps with a hobby, then there's going to be a lot of what I call like dreamers competing in the space. There's going to be a lot of people who aren't serious about business. They're not serious about getting paid for their time. And it's really hard to compete with dreamers. It's hard to compete with people who don't value their time. They don't know how to run a company. They don't know how to charge the right prices and so on. So when you look at the markets completely unemotionally, like I'm going to look at the best opportunity for me to make X with my time. Like, okay, maybe I want to make $100 an hour. And it might sound silly that you can make $100 an hour power washing, but absolutely you can. You can make $100 an hour doing almost any home service company, right? Because people are getting worse and worse at being handy, like being able to fix and maintain and do things around their homes. And they're also busy. People are very busy and they're very willing to pay people to come to their house, to clean their house, to you know, clean anything on the outside of their house, to mow their lawns, to do basic maintenance. So you look at opportunity that's not fun, that's not sexy, that is sweaty. It can be a good opportunity to make money because nobody does those things for fun. Mm-hmm. And when people say like, okay, I don't like doing that and it's not fun, that's kind of a common misconception around entrepreneurship. Everybody says, do what you're passionate about. You hear people say like, do what you're passionate about. I think that is a lie. Like that's a selfish way to be an entrepreneur. That's about like me. I want to do something that's fun. So I'm going to do this. So most entrepreneurs, it's all about them, mm-hmm. not about other people. How can I serve other people, add a lot of value to the world and get paid for that? It's more like, oh, what do I want to do? Yeah. That's the wrong way to look at it. Because as an entrepreneur, and you know this, Dave, as you build a company, any company, whether it be something fun or not fun, what you're doing is the same. It's hiring, training, delegating, solving problems, selling. Those things, if you're running an actual company with employees, you're not going to be doing the actual service. You can't run and build a big web development firm as the CEO and still build websites, right? You're hiring, training, delegating, dealing with people. So all businesses are the same fundamentally when it comes to what you do if you're an entrepreneur with 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 employees.
Got it. Okay. So the second objection I think a lot of people would have to this whole approach is, what if it's a dead end? You know, so I'm cleaning gutters, I'm power washing, you know, I'm mowing lawns, I'm doing whatever. And it's like, I'm doing this over and over, 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road, I'm doing the same thing. And I'm not, the business isn't expanding like, you know, like I was dreaming, let's say. And that's what I'm scared of. What do you say to that type of objection?
That's a very, very real fear of mine as well. On my platform, I'm talking about these businesses and it's hard. It's a lot harder than I make it sound. It's really hard to know how to charge enough money to build a scalable company. It's really hard to hire that first employee. It's really hard to delegate yourself out of actually doing the physical labor. So my fear is that a lot of people who listen to me, they find themselves 10 years later and they're still breaking their back outside to make $20, $30, $40 an hour, and they're not building wealth, and they don't have a valuable company. Mm-hmm. Business is hard. Business is really, really hard. It's not for everybody. And frankly, I don't know that you can really teach it to some degree. Like you either have it or you don't, and you have to be a competent communicator, leader, salesperson to build a company. And unfortunately, most people aren't. So most people can't build a company. Most people can't learn to build a company. Hate to be a downer, but that's just business is really, really hard. Life is hard.
Mm-hmm. How important do you think is geography? Like, for example, if you're doing the same thing in kind of this remote rural town with, like, you know, 5,000 people, and you're forced to stay in that town, like, you know, would it be harder? I mean, does it matter to be in proximity to, let's say, more people, let's say a metro area, even mm-hmm. you know, bigger markets? Like, how do you view that?
Yeah, of course, those are better opportunities, right? The bigger the market, the more the competition, the more customers there are. So it's a balancing act, right? You can find out, I think on my website, it's called Essential Tools on my website, or it's called like how to figure out, find opportunities. So if you click on my website, there's a button that says start here. It's like how to figure out what opportunity is worth. It's called Idea Generation 101. And basically you make a list of things that you think you can do with little money. Okay. Mm-hmm. Power wash, clean somebody's house, do these things. Then you get on Google and you figure out how hard it is to find companies to do those things. And if there's a lot of companies that answer the phone first call, running Google AdWords, really eager for your business, probably not a great opportunity. If you can't actually find anybody to clean your house, maybe you got an Airbnb that you need cleaned and you can't find anybody to do it. That happened to me. I have a home in upstate New York, cannot find any cleaning company within 50 miles. It's impossible. Hmm. Even though it's very rural, it's in a very rural small town, I would be happy to pay somebody $500 to come clean my house. I can't find it. Hmm. So can be an advantage, can be a disadvantage. It's called sweatystartup.com/idea-generation-101. It's got a little analytical approach to seeing where opportunities might arise.
Yeah. After you've started, you know, sharing these ideas on Twitter, on YouTube, on Reddit, elsewhere, how have you kind of seen the feedback? Have you had people contact you saying, oh my gosh, you know, I've started this business and it's working out? Or are you getting maybe also people who are saying, I'm struggling, you know, maybe I started something, but I'm stuck. Like, what has been the feedback from people?
It's mixed. I think a lot of people are just starting to notice. I've opened their eyes to the fact that, okay, you look at the wealthy people in your town, not the wealthy people in the world, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the people who have started big companies, the wealthy people in your town, the ones who live in the big houses, the ones who go to the country club, the ones who, you know, have generational wealth, they've started to notice that a lot of that money comes from service businesses, pest control companies, roofing companies, cleaning companies. That's a lot of the wealth is coming from those areas. So we're kind of opening their eyes to that. And yeah, a lot of people have started companies, which is pretty cool. And they send me emails and say, hey, I quit my job a year ago because of what I heard you say on the Sweaty Startup. And I just want you to know that I made $190,000 last year and it's going amazing. So I'd say a mixed bag.
Okay. So it seems like one of the values that I'm hearing from you is just the value perhaps of learning how to run a business, understanding, you know, there's revenue, there's expenses, how to hire people, how to manage people, how to market. And would you say that, like, if you do a sweaty startup, if you just go out and hustle, that is part of the value that you'll get is just understanding business. And then that gives you at least opportunity to be able to take the next step of, okay, so I understand the basics of business, in and out, people, you know, service, all this stuff. Now I could take it to the next level and, you know, expand it to another location or to more people. Is that kind of how you're, one aspect of seeing it? And I guess the question being, how important is it in this whole picture just to get to learn how to run a business?
You hit the nail on the head. I think if there's one thing that people can take away from this talk that you and I are having, it's the leverage that you gain by putting yourself out there. Life is all about leverage. If you have a network, if you have capital, if you have skill, if you have the ability to hire and train and delegate, those things can be leveraged to build yourself up over time. I mean, my story is so similar, right? You work your way from a really hard service business and you work your way to an easier, more profitable business. So as people get to put themselves out there and you looking back when I was in the thick of it in 2013 and we were working so hard on this company, you'd think I was doing it for the money. Like, that's what I was doing it for. I was doing it to make money, period. But looking back now, the most valuable part of that was what I was learning, what the ability to delegate and hire and manage and sell yourself and your ideas. Because as an entrepreneur, you're selling yourself all day. And I think sales is one of the most important things in life. You're selling your ideas to your mission to your employees. You're selling your service to your customers. You're selling the value proposition to your investors. You're selling all day. Yeah, I think it's about momentum, right? You work your way from harder to easier businesses. And when you leverage, when you leverage the skill set that you gain by getting out and making money and servicing customers and selling yourself, it's just the opportunities that come are really, really surprising over time.
Yeah. So one other thing I've noticed you refer to many times is just kind of using Jobber or other type of, you know, online services to make running a business easier, but making client, the work for clients to pay and to schedule to all that stuff easier. And I'm a big fan of that because, like, for different people that, you know, I use around the house, they actually, nowadays, a lot of people are using, you know, tools like Jobber, but it makes it so much easier. And it's a huge difference between, you know, people who use something like that and people who don't. Do you think, like, what's going to happen? Like, will eventually everybody just use services like, you know, Jobber, who make it easy to pay and to schedule and all this stuff? Or do you think it's going to be quite a while before, you know, all service jobs move over? And is that an opportunity, right, for people?
I mean, it's an opportunity. Life is all about choosing your competition, period. Like, I'm about choosing my, as an entrepreneur, I'm like water. I'm finding the easiest way down the hill. I'm finding the path of least resistance to accomplish my goals. And it's about competition. Who would I rather compete with? The folks in Y Combinator and the Stanford grads and the MBAs and the venture capital firms, or the guy over here in Athens that mows my lawn, that makes really good money and has a profitable company with 7 crews and probably makes 400 or 500 grand a year, but runs the whole company by handwritten ledgers and fax machines. Right? I mean, that's the bottom line. So yeah, when it comes to software is advancing really quickly, and so many of these companies that offer these services operate like it's 1980. You know, they have a secretary sitting at a desk. They don't use email. They don't use, they don't have a website. And these are the companies that you're competing with. So yeah, it's a pain to send our lawn care company checks every month, but there's no other way to pay them. Yeah, there's no other way to pay them. Yeah, so companies like Jobber, you can, in for a couple hundred bucks a month, you can have a form on your website where customers can get a quote request right then. Mm-hmm. You can fill out a quote, send it back to them in a really, you know, professional format right then. They can accept a quote and make their first payment right online. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an amazing advantage when it comes to getting customers, and you can charge more. You can charge a lot more money when you make it that easy.
Yeah. It seems like you're pushing the envelope with this, with hiring folks from the Philippines to run a lot of your self-storage business. Can you share, like, how many people you've hired overseas and how are they actually helping you run your, you know, domestic self-storage business in the US here?
Yeah, it's a labor crisis in the United States. I mean, you talk to any entrepreneur or any business owner, their number one thing is it's really, really hard to find good talent right now. We're spending, you know, whereas 10 years ago, companies were spending 8% of their income or revenue on marketing for customers. That is being cut down to maybe 2 or 3%. And the other 5 to 6% is on marketing to employees, trying to find employees to work for them. Wages are going up, which is great for the middle class, but so paying more is a great option. You know, we pay our Americans very, very well, but sometimes there's just not enough people to do the work. And that's when finding super competent folks in the Philippines who you can pay $5 an hour and it's a phenomenal wage for them over there. It's been a lifesaver for our company.
Like, what specific things do they do?
You know, at first I thought it was just going to be answering the phone and collecting payment. Simple things, right? The things that we can automate and make very simple. We have a head of customer service in the Philippines that's managing 7 other employees. He's solving problems. Customers are going to our front gate asking us to help them find their unit, and he knows how to get around our buildings and direct them to the correct unit and to solve problems dealing with contractors. You know, the skill set over there, we're very, very comparable, if not better, than the average American.
So how many employees do you have? I guess curious. Like,
yeah, so we have 38 total employees.
Okay.
Four in Colombia and 18 in the Philippines.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's become such a global world in a lot of ways. You could run your business remotely. Have people from around the world help you as well. A few more questions here. So you've mentioned your partner a few times. I know it's often difficult to find someone who you can partner with, because like, how do you find someone with, you know, on the same level of commitment, time, dedication, even risk, tolerance and ambition, all this stuff. So how has it been, you know, with your partner over the years? Were you guys just lucky? How did you guys find each other?
Yeah, it was luck. We were good friends. I knew that he was competent. And we shook hands on the very first day. And I got very lucky that I found somebody who was extremely competent, had good moral values. I think all partnerships fail. The partnerships that fail, they all fail for one of two reasons. One being morals. Somebody literally doesn't have your best interests in mind. They're a bad actor. And the other being competence. Are they bringing enough to the table? So all partnerships fail from one of those two reasons. Luckily I found somebody who is more competent, you know, than I am, and, has a solid moral background that I can really trust, and they have, we look out for each other's best interest. So
did you meet in college? Was it?
We did. We were roommates.
So. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. So, I mean, that helps too, probably living together.
You get to know somebody. Yeah. I've gotten better over the years, but one of my, you know, the core, you know, things about me that has led to some of the success that we've had is my ability to really communicate and manage expectations. Life is all about communicating and managing expectations, whether it be with friendships, with your spouse, with your business partners, with your customers. If you can underpromise and overdeliver, the people on the other side of the table are going to be really happy if you underpromise and overdeliver. Now, if you overpromise, honey, I'll be home at 5, and you show up at 5:30 every day. Or, hey, I'm going to take care of this and we don't need to worry about these customers. I'm going to go service them perfectly. And it doesn't happen. It gets really hard. But if you have the courage right off the bat, when somebody asks you a question and you know that it's really tough to deliver, most people make the sale. They tell the person what they want to hear. They tell the person on the other side of the table what they want to hear and say, yes, I can do that. Whether it be a customer, a partner, a spouse, a friend, an employee, whatever it is. It's really hard, but so much more advantageous to say, you know what? I don't think we can do that. You know, I'm going to try, but I think much more realistically, it's next week or the week after. I'm just going to be honest with you. I think that's where we are. Now, if I'm your guy, I'm your guy. I'm going to do the best that I can, but I can't lie to you and tell you I can get this done today.
Yeah. I think, I noticed actually that a lot with various folks is oftentimes when they communicate, or let's say it's not just sales, but working with people, they'll be like, oh, I'll do this, you know, I'll get it to you by tomorrow, you know, oh, I'll do this, but it doesn't happen, right? They're like, tomorrow comes, it passes, it's the next day, you have to remind them, and they're like, oh yeah, I'll get it to you tonight or something. And it's this focus on kind of thinking that you'll please the person if you promise a certain result, and that's what they're expecting you to say that. Whereas I think what you're alluding to is this other route. And I totally see this other route where it's like, rather than focusing on the results or the promise of results, what I like to do or suggest is like focus more on like what you are what you're doing. Like meaning, I'll work an hour on this today and do my best, you know, or something like the process more of how you're going to do it. You know, rather than focusing on some type of unrealistic results, you know, and if you focus on the process, a lot of people are going to be understanding. That's what they want to know, how hard you're working, what type of person you are, whether they can trust you or not. Right. But when you overpromise, you're breaking all of that. You break the relationship, you know, and then it just goes downhill from there. But it's like such an important thing.
You talk about living a stressful life, right? How to live a stressful life is promise a bunch of people things and then, you know, I can't do this. I got to push it back. I mean, it helps people on both sides. And man, what you said was so, I want to take that 45 seconds of you talking right there. And I want to show it to everybody I know, because it's so important in life is to, okay, the sales environment, you want to just tell people what they want to hear. You want to tell people what they want to hear. And that's old school sales, right? This is it. Like, let's go pushy. the new school sales is, hey, look, this is a hard job. These are the things that can go wrong. These are the risk factors. This is what I'm doing. This is the process. This is how we operate. And this is why we're professionals. And this is why we can be trusted. But maybe we're not, maybe this is not, you know, as easy as we thought. And it turns out that builds trust and builds a really strong relationship that's so beneficial over time.
Yeah, definitely. Really interesting stuff. You've mentioned generational wealth a few times. I'm curious, what are you teaching your kids? I know you have young kids. Are you teaching them about business, about money? Like, what's your approach?
Yeah, this is really hard. I think business is hard, but life is harder. How much money do you need to be happy is a question that most people haven't done the work to figure out. I don't know that I've even done the work to figure it out. I know that it's not as much as we all think. I know that. And I know that raising kids who have a strong work ethic, who have low entitlement. I think entitlement is one of the nastiest things that people could have, is think that they're entitled to something because where they were born or who their parents are. And, you know how to treat people. Raising kids that know how to work and know how to treat people well is really hard. And it's something that I'm stressed about. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. I'm just going to do my best to communicate with them, keep from giving them what they need all the time, and make them work for it and make them earn their keep. And so that I can send kids off who can add value to the world and can, you know, make something of themselves, because I think that's ultimately how you live a rewarding life too, right? The people who are the happiest are the ones who feel like they are, you know, contributing. And I get what gets me really feeling good about a work day is when I've moved the needle forward and I feel like I'm being productive and I feel like I'm making things happen. So I think that's the gift I'm going to try to give to my kids. And when it comes to money, I think generational wealth is a blessing. I don't think it's a curse if you treat it the right way. I do want to set my kids up with opportunities, whether it be to buy real estate, to make investments, to live a better life. Money's a big part of that. I just have to make sure that the kids are responsible enough to, you know, handle it the right way. Being a steward of money is very difficult. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one because, I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and it gets to a point where I'd love your feedback on this, but I feel like at a certain point, it gets demotivating. For example, if you're giving your kids X amount of money, let's say hypothetically, when you pass or a future date,
let's say even a trust,
mm-hmm. and let's say in this trust fund or whatever, let's say from 18 years old, right? Let's say mm-hmm. they're getting a amount where they don't need to work anymore, right? They don't mm-hmm. need to go out and hustle and find opportunity because this money comes in every month and it's more than enough to live on. I kind of wonder, I question, like, is that going to change how they view the world, change their motivations, their goals, their aspirations, their connection with the world? And is there a different way to do it then? Let's say not giving, let's say, a guaranteed monthly, whatever, or yearly amount. Is there a way to do it where they need to earn it, right? Or they need to work for it somehow? Have you thought that far kind of down the road, like how you might structure things, you know, as you transfer wealth to your kids?
I don't think there's a real good answer. I really don't. I've spent a lot of time mm-hmm. thinking about it. I think the best thing that we can do is nurture an environment where our kids are challenged, right? They're challenged by sports. They're challenged by life, because life is hard for everybody. No matter how much money you have, we could set our kids up to be getting $25,000 a month for the rest of their lives mm-hmm. and life would still be really hard for them. They'd struggle with friendships. They'd struggle with addictions. They'd struggle with all the things that people struggle with. So I'm just going to try to create an environment where my kids are challenged and they enjoy the challenge. Like I want a challenge to excite them so that they don't care about the money. They just want to move the needle. They want to attack their dreams. They want to chase after their adventurers. They want to do those things. But yeah. I don't know how to make sure that happens.
Yeah. I mean, on the flip side, like I understand what you're saying. On the flip side though, it's like, if a kid, let's say 18-year-old or 25 or whatever gets, even if it's 10,000 a month, you know, or 20,000, whatever it is, it's like There would be a lot of people who say, that kid doesn't have any problems. It's like all the problems that they so-called have are just kind of more minor issues, you know, because right, they have housing, they have food, they have security, they have, you know, mm-hmm. the basic needs.
Yeah, it's not real suffering.
Yeah. That's right. And I guess that kind of like, how important is it to have that type of grit where you're determining your own future rather mm-hmm. than some type of guaranteed income or assets? I mean,
That's a real case for not passing on generational wealth, for sure. Is that the way you're leaning?
Yeah. So I've been reading actually about this. I'm like, how do other people do this, right? I mean, because at a certain point, it's like, you know, if money compounds, it gets to this point where it's like, do my kids really need X amount, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously, at a certain point, they don't. But can they use that for good? Like, can they be motivated? Kind of like what you're saying. Can they have that hunger to create value and to help people and to be good stewards, right, of this and take it to another level? And is there a way to structure kind of, you know, the giving of generational wealth in a manner that allows that? So I've come up with some crazy stuff where it's like like I'm drafting this outline where, for example, every year they get a certain amount to invest in a sub kind of brokerage account that after 5 or 10 years, if they can beat the S&P 500 index by a certain amount, they keep the full amount, right? If they can't, then they don't get anything. They get zero from that year's kind of investment allotment. And also there's another thing where possibly like they get money to start a business that, you know, if it goes to a certain point, they keep all of it. Right? It's just mm-hmm. certain kind of like motivating things, yeah. you know, where it's like either or, you know, like they need to like go for it or they get nothing, kind of, you know, many, many opportunities or chances for that. But it gets kind of complicated the more I put it together.
What if our children don't like investing like we do?
Exactly.
Like we love investing. We're very interested in it. What if their interests are totally different? And
exactly.
I'm going to want to support my kids, but then it becomes even more complicated with the money. So
yeah,
that's really fascinating. Really fascinating. Thank you for sharing that.
And is there a basic kind of just like, you know, just support of their livelihood that you don't want them to go under, for example, right? That could be helpful, right? Maybe, you know, who knows what that minimum amount is, but maybe it's not too much, but it's just enough where it gives them, you know, help that is needed, especially if I'm not here, right, as a parent and my, mm-hmm. my wife isn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The really exciting thing is that we're going to be able to watch them grow up, and hopefully we're still both going to be healthy and mentally sound when our children are 40 and 50, and we're going to get to see them develop and work with them and challenge them. And, you know, and maybe it doesn't have to be as simple as us just giving it to them. Maybe it can, you know, maybe there can be some nuance and decisions made along the way if we're lucky.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of possibilities, yeah, especially when you think that far out. I want to ask you for some practical tips for people who are like, okay, I kind of get this, but so first off, can you give kind of like a rundown of a sample business, let's say a cleaning business or something, but let's start with the whole idea generation and validation, you know, calling Google, you know, mm-hmm. et cetera, and let's, can you go into that? What if it failed? What if there's too many people doing it? So, and then you pivot to another idea. So take us through mm-hmm. kind of like one sample idea that, you know, maybe you need to pivot from to get to another place.
Yep. I think the first thing is that you need to be able to charge $50 per hour of labor to build a sustainable business. If you can't get that money for your service, then it's not viable. If it takes you 3 hours and you can only bill $100, that doesn't hit the threshold, throw that business away.
Okay.
But you know, let's say you want to start a house cleaning company. It's simple. All you need is a $50 worth of stuff from Home Depot and a vacuum that you already have at the house. So I'm going to put that on a list, and I'm going to, in my town, around 10 miles around my house, I'm going to call every company that is a cleaning company. I'm going to Google cleaning company, Athens, Georgia. I'm going to look at the results. I'm going to start to study those companies. I'm going to look, how much do they charge? How, you know, get a fake quote on my house. Have them come and give me a quote on my house. Then I'm going to see how hard it is to get on their schedule. How busy are they? Are they booked out 2 weeks? That's great. Are they available next day? Not ideal. So let's say they're booked out 2 weeks. Let's say it's a hard, you know, they're loaded with business. They got all that they can handle. And let's say they charge, you know, probably don't charge enough money if they're booked out 2 weeks. We're going to charge more, and we're going to be available in 1 week or 3 or 4 days. So I'm going to figure out what I need to charge to be $50 an hour. And I'm going to put out some door hangers. I'm going to put a quick WordPress website up for free. I'm going to get a Google My Business location. I'm going to drop the pin on my house. I'm going to start getting some customers. I'm going to go out and I'm going to clean some houses, fiddle around with the pricing until, you know, this can be in my spare time, aside from my job, while I'm, you know, earning some extra money. And as I get busier, I'm getting closer to quitting my job. I'm making $50 an hour, which is $100,000 a year if I do it all the time, full time. So I can quit my job when I get 20 hours a week, $50,000 a year. I can quit my job because I have a little bit of money saved up. Then I'm ready to hire my first cleaner. Then I'm ready to hire another cleaner. Then I'm ready to implement a little bit of marketing. And from there, you're building the business. So I think this is idea generation 101 is at the beginning of what I just said. You can link that in the show notes if you want to. There's a list of business ideas, which is sweatystartup.com/businesses-i-love. There's about 300 service business ideas that you can look for ideas. And then there's also essential tools to start a business, where I got about 30 things that are all almost free, like Asana, Slack, Google Voice, Google My Business locations, all these things that you can, you know, implement inside your company to have a functioning company. And that's on, we can link to that too. But if there's one thing I get people to take away, it's look up from your computer screen, right? Not all businesses have to be online. Look up from your computer screen. There might be some opportunities right in your small town. That's the exciting stuff.
Yeah. Awesome. So what I've noticed is just throughout our conversation, also some other stuff I've picked up from you is, here's some feedback from my end. So you've got like this combination of, you have this hunger, kind of this motivation where you're like, you know, you're just not satisfied with, let's say, the typical mediocre, you're wanting to push it. And you've done that from a very young age. I'm not sure exactly what the motivation is, like where that comes from. Is it just innate that you're very motivated, very driven? Or is there some type of external goal you're reaching for, whether it's a certain lifestyle or a certain money amount or certain things you can do? With that, have you kind of processed that? Where does that kind of hunger and motivation come from?
I think you look at most successful entrepreneurs and it's almost all comes down to energy. We have a conversation about some of these business ideas. Some people are energized right now. Mm-hmm. Some people listening to this thing are like, oh my gosh, this is exciting to me. And some people are like, what are these guys talking about? This is the most boring. Like, can you imagine trying to do that? And then they're just throwing a Cheeto in their mouth and they're sitting in the chair. I don't know. I've always been excitable. I've always been energetic and passionate about little things that other people are not excited about, that other people think are stupid, sweaty, not good opportunities. I've always been like, wow, there's something here. And obviously that wears off when you're in, you know, the first 3 months of starting a company it's exciting. You're getting new customers. You got a website built. You're seeing massive gains. Month three to year three. Have you ever read The Dip by Seth Godin? It's literally, it just gets not fun. It's a trudge. It's work. And that's when the energy has to keep you going. It's when the energy has to keep you going. But also it can be a curse, right? The fact that entrepreneurs are excitable and in a way like attention deficit disorder, like we're excited about a lot of things. So we're going to go from this to this to this. We're going to be serial entrepreneurs. Everything's exciting. We're going to say yes to everything. Oh my God, now I'm overloaded with stuff. Nothing's going well. I haven't focused enough to get anything done. So the balance between having that energy where something silly to most people is exciting to you and being able to focus on it and not get sidetracked is also like, that's the perfect combination of somebody who's going to be really successful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's interesting observation. I noticed. Okay. So the second thing I wrote down in terms of feedback is you've got this, you add to this hunger, motivation, this opportunity, like you see opportunity where perhaps others don't. And, you understand what it means, you know, and I resonate with that a lot because I'm like, I think for so many, there's so much opportunity around. They're just not like picking it up, you know? And it's just the opportunity where you can actually knock on doors and actually provide a service, you know, and build a business from that. It's like, that's a huge, immense opportunity. But for most people out there, they don't see opportunity around them. They're like, hey, you know, I'm stuck in my job. I'm making 30, grand a year and there's no promotion, no opportunity, and life sucks. Like the hand I've been given just is terrible, right? And so what I'm kind of sensing from you and that what I resonate is like you're flipping it upside down. You're saying, no, sure, everyone has their hardships, life gets hard, but you know, there's a ton of opportunity out there if you'll just look at it. And one of the places you're looking is like, just call Google, call the phone, you know, and see like who's like stuff that needs to get done. People don't like to do, they want other people to do, but there's just not enough people providing that service, right? That's a huge opportunity that's like undiscovered. But I just noticed like, it seems like you carry that whole opportunity awareness to not just your first startup, but also to everything you're doing, you know, to your next, your self-storage and your raising money. And it just seems like a theme that's going on. I mean, just curious, do you have any feedback or thoughts on that type of attitude?
I really appreciate those. Those are really kind words. And I think that is what I'm trying to spread around. I think everybody thinks it's all really complicated. Everybody thinks that what I do is really complicated, that what entrepreneurs do is really complicated, that what you do is complicated, and that they can't possibly do it. First of all, you have a lot of haters out there who all they do is hate on the people who are actually doing things. They're not doing anything. They're just hating on the people who do things. And when you get that attitude of, oh my gosh, I'm just going to hate on everybody who does things, then you think that that's how everybody operates, and they just can't wait to pile on you when you fail. They can't wait to pile on when you fail. And it just drives a deep sense of insecurity in a lot of people that think, oh, look at how much hate all these people are out doing something. Yes, I don't want that. That's too scary. And that's a shame, because those are the cheap seats. That's the minority of people. Most people want people to thrive and succeed. Most people worth knowing want other people to win. They like it when their friends do well. They like to see people get wealthy. They like to see people succeed and win and do great things. Only a small, loud subset of people have a scarcity mindset that's not like that. But back to how complicated and how simple things can be, people always DM me. I'm sure this happens to you, Dave. Like, how do you build the great brand and YouTube following that you have, Dave? There must be some trick. You gotta tell us the secrets. And I get the same thing. Nick, how do you buy a storage facility? It seems so complex. This is craziness. And it's not. It's not complex. Like, what do you think, if you want to buy a storage building from somebody, what do you think is the best way to get a hold of them? People think, oh, I got to have algorithms. I got to have all this data. I got to do this mailer campaigns. I got to have all these ways to reach owners. Dave, I pick up my phone and I call them. Mm-hmm. I call them on the phone. Okay, Nick, how do you find investors who want to invest in your deals? Yeah, I ask people who they know that might want to invest in deals. Mm-hmm. How did you build your student storage company? Well, we got in a van, we drove around, and we picked up somebody's stuff, and then we put it in a place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not that complex. It's obviously you have a lot of, I'm oversimplifying it in a lot of ways. You have a lot of decisions to make. You have a lot of things that you need to do, but people think it's really complex when it's really not. And they're not as a sense of resourcefulness, a sense of, hey, I can figure out this answer. There's no correct answer here, but I can figure it out and it's going to be just fine. So every day when I started my company, I made 100 decisions. I made 50 of them really poorly, but I made the big decisions, I made them right. I made those decisions right and I still succeeded. Every day I make a lot of mistakes, and the good decisions that I make outweigh those mistakes. You can make mistakes and still win. So I think how do you spot opportunity, and why do I have such a abundance mindset that there's opportunity everywhere and I just can't believe how much opportunity there is? I think it could, like, a simple actionable takeaway, I've been getting pretty philosophical, maybe losing a lot of people. I think a simple actionable takeaway is just to think about how businesses make money when you go about your day. Mm-hmm. When you walk out of your house and you look at a garbage truck driving down the driveway, think of, hey, that's a garbage company. They charge every house in this neighborhood $50. Stop by and pick it up. How long does it take them to pick up the trash? Well, I'm doing the math here. It takes them 35 seconds per house, $50 per month, 4 visits. They're getting $50. That's 12 visits, $12 per visit to the house, because they're coming once a week, $12 per visit per month, and it takes them 35 seconds. Damn, that's probably pretty profitable when you can pick up 40 houses in an hour, and and those guys on there are making X money. Just start to think about how these businesses make money. Walk in a donut shop. How many donuts does this place need to sell to be making money? Look at a lawn care company. How many lawns does this company need to be servicing? What do they need to be charging to make money? And as you as you practice that and you walk around the world and everywhere you go, you'll start to drive your family members nuts. My wife is always like, Nick, who cares how much this place is making money? Like, why do you do this? But that's how you spot opportunity.
Yeah, it's crazy because like I resonate with a lot of the stuff you're saying. Like when I walk into a store or a restaurant, I'm like, okay, how many employees? I'm like, I can't even stop myself. Right? I'm like, one employee, two employee, third, fourth, fifth. Okay, I see two, three in the back, and then I go, okay, this is the cost of, you know, their salaries. And I go, how many people are in the store right now? What time of day is it? In the day of the week, and how many customers per day per order are they getting? You know, how does this work out? And I'm telling my wife, you know, I think this restaurant is barely breaking even. It's making like 100,000. She's like, what in the world? How do you know that from, you know, this one visit here? ridiculous.
I was in a bar when Georgia was playing Alabama for the national championship, and it's a cocktail bar, and they make a lot of very neat cocktails, but they also have about 20 beers on draft. Well, there's three bartenders working, and there was 50 people waiting on a drink. 50 people waiting on a drink, and they kept getting hung up by cocktails that would take these guys 6, 7, 8, 10 minutes per drink to make. Yeah. When in reality, somebody should have just said, "Who wants a beer?" and started slinging beers to the people who wanted beers, and they could have sold. They could have increased their volume by a triple. I mean, most people at that bar would have said, "I'll take a beer over waiting another 25 minutes for a drink."
Yeah. It's also interesting. Like, I think that's one of the best educations for kids, like to actually, you know, be able to go to any store, any business, and just like naturally fling off all the numbers that they're seeing based upon, you know, the salaries that the product sold and how much is sold and what kind of margin they can get on these products. I mean, the education opportunity is just immense. You have all these case studies all around you. It's like a crazy opportunity.
I think we need to do this more often, David. We riff pretty well.
Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of this stuff, it just feels like it's goldmine stuff that is just overlooked, you know? I mean, it's just such an opportunity because everywhere you go, you get to see how a business is doing. You see the demand for certain products just by going to your local stores, you know? You see like how many people are there, how the pricing works, everything. It's just like, man, it's gold.
When you call some service companies and they tell you that they don't have any availability on their calendar for 2.5 months.
Yeah.
Which is very, very, very real. That's real.
Yeah.
How can you not just think that opportunity is dripping in those areas?
Yeah. So this final kind of observation, you know, I was making is you bring up, in our conversation, kind of this, the need or the skill, the advantage of actually personal relationships, knowing how to, you're talking about selling, but not just selling, like pushing it, but actually establishing a rapport, a trust, over-delivering. And yeah, I think this is something that just is so powerful, but overlooked as well. I mean, and I don't know how much of it was formed from your early business experience. Like when I look back to myself, like I did a paper route back in the day when I was like maybe in junior high and high school for maybe 3 or 4 years. And I had to like collect all the money in hand, you know, knock on doors and actually get the actual like $8 a month, you know, from each person and keep on going back until they give me that money. Right. And handle late payments, all this stuff. And and I think just at a young age, getting involved with that stuff, it just demystifies everything. You know, it's not a big deal anymore. You know, just like picking up the phone or, you know, knocking on a door. It's just like, whatever, it just needs to get done. And they're not, you know, it's especially when you have some type of relationship where you're delivering paper. So it's not like you're bothering them. It's just whatever. I don't know. I'm curious, like when you look back, like has anything helped you with that kind of connection, the ability to feel comfortable talking with people, and seeing the potential, you know, that has helped you with business.
Yeah, I think I was naturally given a dose of emotional intelligence just in my life. I've always been able to read how people feel, what kind of mood they're in, how they're reacting to what I'm saying mid-conversation. I can kind of read that. Mm-hmm. But if somebody wants an actionable takeaway, there's a book by Oren Claff called Flip the Script, and it talks about selling a different way. And it's not selling as in telling about all the good things and telling about how amazing it is and then pressuring them to sign on the dotted line. it's selling by working through a process where you're showing them that you're a professional. Hey, Dave, let's just say you're sitting on an investor call with me. I'm trying to convince you to invest in one of my storage deals. Dave, like, I'll tell you, the storage business is a great business. We have a lot of good tailwinds, but my investors don't pay me to talk about the good things. If you're going to invest with me, you need to understand that, hey, real estate's very cyclical. We could buy this building and 5 years from now, it could be worth half of what we're paying for it. Operations is the risk factor. Like, we're managing these things remote. It's a tough job. We're learning a lot as we go. The market's heating up. Everybody's, you know, we're paying up for assets. It's a tough market right now. And interest rates could go up. If interest rates go up, then we're not going to hit our return metrics. And that's out of our control. These are the things that are out of my control. Interest rates and what somebody else will pay for my property. I can't control either of those two things. And they're so huge in our business. So these are the things that I'm doing to, you know, protect us. These are the things, like, I don't need to sell it at a specific time. So that's great. And if interest rates go up, we have a lot of cash flow, but we'll miss our projections and things get really tough. Mm-hmm. And when you start to, when you lead an environment like that, and then I always say, like, you know, what do you like about storage? You know, what makes you want to invest in storage? And what you end up finding is the person on the other side of the table starts to really respect you. They start to say, oh my gosh, this guy knows the risk. He knows the risk factors. And sometimes that other person will literally start selling themselves and start playing devil's advocate and talking about why they might want to hire your company or why they might want to, you know, work for your company. An employee, it comes on for an interview, just interviewed somebody a few hours ago. Look, this job's hard. These are the things that we don't like about this job. These are the struggles. We try to create a great environment. We treat people with respect. We don't micromanage, but we have mean customers sometimes. Like, or, you know, our reporting gets to be crazy. We go through busy seasons. Like, everybody had to work between Christmas and New Year's last year, and we were really disappointed in that. We compensated folks and we gave them some time off in January, but it was a thing that we were disappointed in. We're working to do our best. Why do you want to work for us? And then they start saying why they don't mind those things and how they would want to overcome them and why, you know, working for a good team might matter. So when you're in a sales environment, I just find it so much more effective to be real with people, to be real.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's actually a few more, but I'll leave that for us for later. I think it's been fascinating actually talking with you. I love the idea. I love the, you know, I think there are a lot of people who especially on my channel, I talk mostly about the investing side, but you know, I think the other side is the revenue or the income side. It's like you can't invest much unless you have something to invest with. And especially the younger person is, the less maybe time they've had to build income and skills. There's this kind of dichotomy or divergence where in your 20s, you know, if you're stuck with a dead end job for 15, 20 years and you're making, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a year, it's like, that's a tough place to be because you're not having the income, and that will kind of shut you off from opportunities to invest and really compound your wealth over time. But if earlier on, you can actually do something that's diverges from the crowd, and you're, you know, I mean, the ultimate divergence, I think, is owning your own business in a sense, because you're controlling your destiny. You own the actual future, you know, of the business. And so, I mean, if you could successfully start something, even if it's small, because those skills can transfer into a next venture, you can close down your old business, you know, super fast, especially if you're not, like, if you don't have a ton of investors. That's another great thing about your approach. Just do it, you know, don't worry about, you know, making it complicated. It's actually easier and better just to get started. And you can use that to, you know, segue into the next business or next opportunity. But yeah, and I mean, one of the things is the whole concept of, like, not giving up either. When you have something that has been proven to work for generations and generations across every country and every city and every, you know, society in the world, which is starting a business, you know, and actually hustling, it's like, it's a matter of, in a way, like, finding the opportunity and then keep on trying. And if you fail, just, you know, another opportunity, keep on trying, failing, whatever. And if you keep on doing that, it's like, what are the chances that you won't find something eventually? You know, it's like, it's just common sense, you know, it's gonna work out in some way. But it's this thing of, I think people don't have either the motivation, the inspiration, they don't perhaps know the know-how, or they don't think it's possible, or, you know, maybe it's just a lot of blockages, I think, you know, for people to actually seize that opportunity or that belief. But yeah, definitely a big fan of a lot of the stuff you've been talking about here today.
Thanks for having me. This has been a great discussion. I really appreciate you having me on, and I'm a huge fan of your work. And if people want to learn more about me, I think my Twitter DMs are open, Sweaty Startup. Cool. And sweatystartup.com is where, you know, a lot of my stuff is. Like, I have two podcasts, one on service business called mm-hmm. The Sweaty Startup, and one called The Nick Huber Show. It's on kind of in the weeds on real estate and real estate private equity. But awesome. I have a lot of stuff out there.
Cool. I'll go ahead and link to your Twitter account, your podcast, YouTube channel in the video description below. Nick, it's been a fun time. Great getting to know you as well. All right, we'll see.
Let's do it again. I really appreciate having me.
Cool, bye. Man.